This is Nightly Business Report with Tyler Matheson and Sue Herrera.
One further increase in the federal funds rate would likely be appropriate this year.
The Fed chair tells investors to get ready for at least one more rate hike. Maybe that's all. And the Dow rallies to a record.
The new Buffett way, Warren Buffett wants to buy a utility. A hedge fund is standing in the way. Now the billionaire investor may do something he usually doesn't do.
Bottom of the list. Yesterday, we revealed America's best state for business. Tonight, the worst. Those stories and more tonight on Nightly Business Report for Wednesday, July 12th.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome. A record finish for the Dow, the world's most recognizable index, rallied after the chair of the Federal Reserve said the central bank plans to increase interest rates, but perhaps not as often as some had thought. Janet Yellen used the word gradual to describe the pace of increases, a word which she's used before, but today the lack of tough talk was enough to send stocks higher. The Dow Jones Industrial Average advanced 123 points to a record 21,532. The NASDAQ added 67, and the S&P 500 was up 17. Steve Leisman has more on why investors liked what they heard.
3 hours of testimony, and as far as the markets were concerned, it all boiled down to one dovish comment from Fed Chair Janet Yellen about interest rates.
Because the neutral rate is currently quite low by historical standards, the federal funds rate would not have to rise all that much further to get to a neutral policy stance.
That comment had been echoed by Fed Governor Lael Brainard, suggesting more than one key central banker embraces the idea that the Fed doesn't really have very far to go when it comes to raising interest rates. And the Fed chair added that the next rate hike is contingent on the inflation data heading back towards the Fed's 2% target.
Monetary policy is not on a preset course. We're watching this very closely and stand ready to adjust our policy if it appears that the inflation undershoot will be persistent.
All of that prompted markets to start baking out the possibility of a third rate hike this year. It's now well below 50%. Bond yields fell and stocks rallied. Yellen also sees global growth helping the U.S. economy this year. She opposes the efforts to audit monetary policy put forward by some Republicans in Congress, and she made no comment when asked about whether she'd serve a second term if nominated by President Trump.
Your term as Fed chair ends in 2018, and there is a long history of presidents renominating Fed chairs. Are you open to serving another 4 years as Fed chair?
What I've previously said is that I absolutely intend to serve out my term. I'm very focused on trying to achieve our congressionally mandated objectives, and I really haven't had to give further thought at this point to this question.
The Fed chair also insisted balance sheet reduction could begin soon, but didn't give a month. Many in the markets think it could happen as soon as September, but it remains possible to be announced at the meeting this month. For Nightly Business Report, I'm Steve Leisman.
A separate report from the Federal Reserve shows the labor markets are getting tighter. According to the so-called Beige Book, an anecdotal look at economic conditions across the country, the job market is strengthening for both low and higher skilled positions, particularly in the construction and IT sectors. But a drop in gasoline prices has kept the lid on inflation, something the Federal Reserve would like to see pick up just a bit. Overall, the central bank reported modest to moderate economic growth, or really kind of beige.
Despite expectations for modest economic growth, historically, the economy tends to cool after a series of interest rate hikes, which the Fed chair alluded to today. But are things different this time around? Peter Bruckfahr is the chief market analyst at the Lindsay Group, and Jack McIntyre is the portfolio manager with Brandywine Global Investment Management. And both gentlemen join us to talk about that. Welcome. Peter, I'm going to start with you. You don't think it's different this time around. And if the tightening continues, we may very well see a recession.
So since World War II, there's been 13 rate hike cycles. 10 have put us into recession. And considering how extreme the easing was, it's not going to take much of a rate of change in the rise in interest rates to have what I believe is a more pronounced effect on asset prices and the economy. particularly in the economy, we saw a 60 basis point increase year over year in mortgage rates, and refis fell 60%. So we're very sensitive to changes in interest rates because we are in credit cycles now, not necessarily economic cycles.
So, Jack, answer Peter here. We have certainly been a long time since the last recession. What? Basically 10 years or thereabouts, nine years or so since the last one began. What do you say?
I think the way I kind of think about this economic expansion, it's not strong, but it can be long. There's not a lot of excesses. We're in an environment where the growth really isn't inflationary, and I just don't think that the Fed has to tighten that much. Therefore, I think that we can continue to see this non-inflationary growth environment unfold for the next couple of years.
You know, Peter, what about that? Because the Fed chief seemed to back off of multiple increases this year. One, do you agree with that, with that theory? And two, if they just hike a little bit and take away some of the accommodation, why couldn't it be long in terms of the expansion, but not necessarily all that strong?
Right, that would be ideal. But the shrinking of the balance sheet, what I call quantitative tightening, to me is a big part of this equation. Because if quantitative easing caused so much euphoria in markets, why should I believe that quantitative tightening is not going to have the serious effect? And I agree that they're not necessarily excesses in the economy, but they're excesses with central bank balance sheets, they're excesses with interest rates, and we have a global bond bubble. So what's going to pop up global bond bubble? It's going to be a removal of accommodation, whether it's raising interest rates or it's shrinking balance sheets. And at the same time, we have the ECB that is likely going to be shrinking their balance sheet as well come September. So in the fall, we're going to have the two major central banks that are quantitatively tightening in a sense. And I think it's a decline in asset prices that will lead us into recession rather than a recession leading to a decline in asset prices.
So it would be that would be the mechanism, Peter says, Jack, not necessarily a slowing of the business cycle per se. I take your point that that economic growth is very slow right now anyhow. And the Fed has certainly promised to be very gradual in whatever it does. But as Peter points out, if not just the U.S. central bank, but the European central bank are taking the lubricant out of the system, could that tip us?
No, and I agree. So I'd make two quick points. One is that I don't think bonds are in a bubble because I think we've got this secular disinflationary pressure that is keeping yields lower. I do agree with Peter in the sense, though, that if the Fed is worried more about asset inflation than regular inflation, then they run a risk of creating some wealth destruction. And that certainly could have a negative impact. But I also think, though, this Fed is pragmatic enough to know that if that does create that financial angst in the markets, then they're going to back away from the quantitative tightening.
Peter, is it the right time for the Fed to raise interest rates? I mean, if the economy is slowing a little bit.
Or should they have done it earlier?
That's a whole nother. That's kind of the elephant in the room. Should they wait?
They should have done it earlier. And they're being forced to tighten at the wrong time from an economic standpoint. But you know, these are rearview mirror type economists. They see the unemployment rate at 4.4%, and they see they have emergency sides balance sheet and a Fed funds rate that's barely above 1%. And they're saying, oh my, we're kind of stuck here, because what happens if the labor market continues to tighten? Now, we can get slower growth in a tighter labor market because it's the supply of labor that's shrinking while the demand is still pretty steady. So it's the lack of supply that actually can continue to slow growth, but then cause inflation wage-wise, so sort of stagflationary type situation, that the Fed is kind of stuck in. So not a good situation, but they put themselves in this.
On that note, Peter, thank you very much. Jack, thank you as well for joining us. Peter Buchvar with the Lindsay Group and Jack McIntyre with Brandywine Global Investments.
And the Royal Bank of Scotland will pay $5.5 billion to settle claims related to its sale of toxic mortgage securities ahead of the financial crisis. The settlement is with the agency that regulates mortgage firms Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. The bank says it continues to cooperate with other investigations that could lead to further settlements or fines.
The Federal Communications Commission is the target of an online protest by some big internet companies. Facebook, Google, Netflix, and others opposed the regulator's decision to reverse a rule that would require internet service providers to treat all internet content equally. Treating all content equally means companies like Comcast, Charter, and AT&T would not be allowed to block content or speed up or slow down data from certain websites. The FCC argues that reversing the rule would decrease regulations and help increase investment in new technology.
Well, the biggest names in technology and media are out in Sun Valley, Idaho, attending Allen & Company's exclusive annual conference. And while that lovely mountain retreat doesn't seem on its face like a place where power deals get done, that is exactly what it turns into this time of year. Julia Boorstin reports.
In beautiful Sun Valley, it's a who's who of media, tech, and investing. People like Warren Buffett, Sherry Redstone, Jeffrey Katzenberg, Reid Hoffman, Bill Gates, and the King of Jordan. Here, they listen to speakers and hear panels in the morning. In the afternoon, they bike and go horseback riding, and behind closed doors, make deals. Discovery CEO David Zaslav said he expects many more media deals.
It feels like there's more pressure on the cable players around the world, satellite and mobile players to merge or to figure out how to offer all those together.
With the merger speculation about their companies, Verizon CEO Lowell McAdams said Verizon's not merging with Disney, and CBS CEO Les Moonves said CBS is not buying Lionsgate.
The other topic dominating this conference, politics, with Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump on the guest list and panels, including one hosted by Tom Brokaw on a nation divided and an interview with CIA Director Mike Pompeo.
The CEOs here discussing what impact President Trump's policies will have on their bottom lines.
If President Trump can implement his agenda of infrastructure spending, of less regulation and lower tax, if he can, that's a boost for the U.S. economy at a time probably that it needs it.
But others, including media mogul Barry Diller, criticize President Trump's policies on immigration, net neutrality, and the environment.
I think it's just a joke. And hopefully it'll be over relatively soon. It inexplicably began and it'll inexplicably end.
But Diller agreed we'll see more media deals. We'll see if any big ones come from the conversations here in Sun Valley. For Nightly Business Report, I'm Julia Boorstin in Sun Valley, Idaho.
Still ahead, it is a label no state wants.
I'm Scott Cohn. You know now that America's top state for business is Washington. But what's the bottom state? We'll tell you coming up on Nightly Business Report.
Warren Buffett is in the middle of a battle for a bankrupt utility. Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway is pushing for fast regulatory action on its takeover of Oncor, one of the largest power transmission systems in the country. But it is battling Elliott Management, Oncor's largest creditor, who also wants to buy the company. In court today, an attorney for Elliott Management complained that Oncor did not provide the information it needed to line up financing for its takeover bid. Oncor instead struck a deal to sell to Berkshire Hathaway. A hearing is set on Berkshire's plan for later this month.
Sometimes Warren Buffett lays low. He can afford to. His Berkshire Hathaway has $100 billion of cash. But lately, the Oracle of Omaha has been as active as a bear in summer. He sold some IBM, become the biggest shareholder in two of the nation's largest banks, Wells Fargo and B of A, and he launched that now-challenged bid for Oncor. Here to discuss what Buffett's moves say about the market, if anything, is Thomas Russo, managing member of Gardner Russo & Gardner. His firm oversees $10 billion, and Berkshire Hathaway is its biggest holding at 12% of assets. Mr. Russo, welcome.
Well, thank you, Tyler. I'm glad to be here.
Well, we're happy to have you. You have a big bet on Berkshire, and you're watching Mr. Buffett take some very big stakes, and this latest one that some people interpret as a defensive stake because it's in a utility business. What do you make of Mr. Buffett's activities lately?
The utility, well, he's been known for years as having, I think, the most valuable asset of all as an investor, which is the capacity to do absolutely nothing. He prizes that ability, and he'll lay low for months, if not years, before deploying capital. There's a lot to deploy now, and there's a lot of cash that comes in every day at Berkshire. So it's good to find someplace to deploy money. And the utility business has been very good to Berkshire over time. The beauty about it is if you pay a relatively attractive, modest entry multiple and consume, in this case, almost $20 billion of cash to acquire the business, what you then get, which is extremely valuable, is the ability to reinvest even more money in the regulated utility business at fixed rates of return. So imagine he paid 10 times cash earnings at the moment if his deal goes through. Right. And then subsequently, on top of the $20 billion that he'll invest here, he'll be able to invest tens of billions of dollars over time at high rates of return, which are part of the regulatory landscape.
So it sounds
it's a predictable business.
It's a predictable business, but he is going up against Elliott Management, which is a tactic that he very infrequently employs. So there are those out there who are interpreting that as a change in strategy for Buffett and for Berkshire Hathaway. It does not sound to me as though you feel it is a change in strategy.
I don't. No, I really don't. I don't think it even expresses a newfound sense of urgency. It's just one of the many cards in Warren's deck that he gets to play, and he'll play it on this particular investment so long as the terms are attractive. And if they're no longer attractive, he has absolute ability to walk away. By being judicious and allocating and acting only when the terms are most favorable is where we've made so much money with Berkshire over the years. For instance, one such example came to fruit last week when he exercised the warrants to buy 700 million options, call options on Bank of America for $7 a share. And today the shares are $24 per share. So he really made $15 billion.
That's how the rich get richer, Thomas, isn't it? That's how the rich get richer.
Investment.
Quick thought on why you think he likes the bank so much right now. Quick.
Well, in the case of, I'd say that they're very reasonably priced. It's as simple as that. They're high single digit, maybe low double digit multiples. There's a huge wall of worry over them as to what the regulations about capital requirements will do to future returns. But they're very, very attractively valued if you believe that the business will resemble anything like it has going forward over time.
Okay.
The past is a good example. Berkshire will do well in its bank stocks.
All right, Mr. Russo, we wish you well. You got 12% in Berkshire. Thomas Russo with Gardner Russo and Gardner.
MSC Industrial suffers its worst day in nearly 15 years. That's where we begin tonight's Market Focus. Sales at the industrial equipment distributor rose last quarter, but much of those gains came from low-margin products, and the results weren't good enough to top analysts' estimates. Earnings matched expectations, but the company sees profit for the current quarter coming up short. Shares dropped 14% to $74.78. Fastenal said growth in its industrial vending machine business helped that company beat sales expectations. Profit at the industrial and construction supplies maker was also ahead of street targets, but the shares still fell 2% to $42.72. Barnes & Noble Education saw revenue rise, while same-store sales at the bookstore operator also edged higher, but earnings missed estimates. The company said it expects sales to be flat in fiscal 2018, and it sees same-store sales falling in the low to mid-single-digit percentage point range. Shares were slammed. They lost 11.5% to $8.89.
You can now use PayPal to make purchases in the Apple App Store. The two companies entered into a partnership that lets customers link their PayPal and Apple accounts to buy music, movies, and books. Shares of PayPal up 3% at $56.55. American Airlines said it expects unit revenue to rise as much as 6% in the second quarter. That's better than what the company originally estimated. Separately, American Airlines said it is ending code share agreements with Qatar Airways and Etihad, as it believes state-owned Gulf Airlines are unfairly subsidized by their governments. Qatar recently was seeking a 10% stake in American Airlines. Shares of American rose 4% to $53.80. An experimental cancer drug made by Novartis is one step closer to winning regulatory approval. A Food and Drug Administration panel voted in favor of recommending the novel treatment that is intended to treat a form of leukemia. The FDA is not obligated to follow the panel's recommendation, but it often does. Novartis shares rose 1.5% to $83.21.
Economists at West Virginia University say the economy in that troubled state is starting to grow again, and that is the good news. The bad news is that the growth is moderate, and it comes years after the national economy began to recover. Little wonder, then, that West Virginia finished dead last in CNBC's annual list of the top states for business. Scott Cohn reports on the Mountain State's long climb ahead.
West Virginians have heard more than their share of promises.
We're going to put the miners back to work. We're going to put the miners back to work.
This is coal country, or it was. In the last 5 years, mining employment is down nearly 43%. Lately, production has begun to come back, but barely a blip in a decline that dates back to the 1940s. And not nearly enough to lift West Virginia from the depths of this year's top states for business rankings. 50th place, its worst finish since the study began. But West Virginians are growing accustomed to finishing last.
There's no question we've been 50th forevermore. We're better than that. Now, like it or not like it, we're dying 50th.
The 50th ranked economy with anemic growth, a depressed housing market, and a state starved for resources. West Virginia has the least educated workforce in the country. Fewer than 12% of adult workers have a bachelor's degree at a time when companies are clamoring for skilled employees. And it ranks 49th for business friendliness, with regulations and courts that some would say are stuck in the past. The state budget battle in Charleston so fierce that first-term Governor Jim Justice went to extremes to describe it earlier this year.
We all should take ownership for this, but what we have is nothing more than a bunch of political bull, you know what.
The substance on the plate is exactly what you think it is. At issue, budget cuts favored by Republicans versus targeted tax and fee hikes proposed by the Democratic governor. But nearly everyone agrees that until West Virginia can transform its workforce, the Mountain State will remain in a deep hole.
Of course, budget battles are not unique to bottom states. Here in the top state, Washington, it took three special sessions of the legislature before they finally came to a deal. In West Virginia, ultimately, Governor Jim Justice refused to sign the budget that the legislature passed, but he didn't veto it either, so it became law. The other bottom states for business, number 46, Maine, number 47, Alaska, followed by Mississippi and Hawaii. In Seattle, I'm Scott Cohn for Nightly Business Report.
And to read more about West Virginia's ranking as the worst state for business, you can head to our website, NBR.com.
Coming up, watch this. How a luxury watchmaker is going all out to wow customers in a slowing market. Amazon's Prime Day sales set a record. The company's third annual event saw sales climb more than 60% compared with last year. They were higher than both Black Friday and Cyber Monday combined. It also added more Prime members in one day than ever before. The most popular item sold was an Amazon product, its smaller-sized Echo Dot smart speaker that listens to you. Shares of Amazon sort of does. Amazon rose today to close above $1,000 a share.
Well, did you buy a watch during Amazon Prime Day? Most of you probably did not. In fact, if you look around you, a lot of people just don't wear watches anymore. Some say there's no need to now that smartphones are ubiquitous, and smartphones and even wearables like smart watches are giving traditional watch manufacturers a headache. Even the high-end luxury watchmakers have to go to great lengths to generate attention. Robert Frank has our story.
The luxury watch wars have reached a whole new level. Swiss watchmaker Patek Philippe is spending millions to rent the famed Cipriani's event space in Midtown Manhattan for an entire month for a pop-up temple to time called The Art of Watches. They built a two-story replica of the Swiss headquarters of Patek, and it's filled with some of the rarest and most expensive watches in the world going back 400 years.
Now, this display is the latest effort by the industry to stop slowing sales as demand from China weakens, and younger consumers are turning to their phones and their smartwatches to tell the time rather than the old-style mechanical watches.
Swiss watch exports totaled $20 billion last year, down for the second year in a row. Only the high-end is doing well. Watches priced at more than $3,000 saw sales surge 13% in May, making it the fastest-growing segment, while watches priced under $200 fell. Now, Patek hopes that the art of the watch will help lure millennials and strengthen its position in the U.S., its top market.
Well, what we're trying to do is expose people to Swiss watchmaking and also the brand. But we want to capture that elusive 20 to 30-year-old next-generation client and teach them a little bit about fine Swiss watches.
Among the historical items on display here, John F. Kennedy's desk clock, made by Patek and given to him during his famous speech in Berlin in 1963. Joe DiMaggio's watch is here, worth over $300,000. The most complicated watch in the world for decades, known as the Caliber 89, is also here, worth $7.5 million. It has a mechanism to offset leap century, which is once every 400 years. Now, for young consumers, Patek, considered the most prestigious watch brand, is introducing a starter watch in stainless steel for only $20,000. The company has been owned by the same family for four generations and says the secret to keeping quality high and production low is thinking long term.
And you know, when you have shareholders, of course you have to be quick, you have to make money very fast, but that's not the point for Patek. My only objective is to make something beautiful.
And no one understands the value of time better than Patek Philippe. For a Nightly Business Report, I'm Robert Frank in Manhattan.
If you're thinking about leap century every 400 years, you're thinking long
term. You're thinking long, long term. All right, that does it for us tonight. I'm Sue Herrera. Thanks for joining us.
It's a half hour's gone by. I'm Tyler Matheson. Have a great evening, everybody. We'll see you tomorrow.